Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey guys, welcome to And the Writer Is. I'm your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of artists and writers over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life, the industry, politics, composition, whatever. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm producing this with the great Joe London, Big Deal Music Publishing, and Mega House Music Management. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, follow us on our socials, find out about special live events, or buy that merch, aka that hat I always wear, go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. For a little bit of context, we just wanted you to know that a lot of these were recorded before quarantine. And as we know, a lot has changed in 2020. So again, please stay safe out there and enjoy the new episodes of And the Writer Is. This week's episode is sponsored by BMI. At BMI, music moves their world just like it moves mine. BMI is my performing rights organization. They're the bridge between people who create music like me and the businesses that bring it to the public. They make sure I get paid when my music is streamed on apps or shows, played on radio, at live shows, or in bars, gyms, basically anywhere where music is played. And they do this for over 900,000 songwriters, composers, and music publishers with more than 14 million songs across genres. But it's more than that. They help us navigate the music industry. They create opportunities for aspiring writers and composers through stages at festivals, song camps, and workshops. And they connect us with the right people. They're also on Capitol Hill fighting for copyright protection and fair royalties. And they work hard to ensure the future of music. They have my back and they'll have yours. Learn more at BMI.com. Today's podcast is brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built for musicians, by musicians. Bandzoogle makes it easy to build a professional website and EPK for your music. Whether you're looking to book more gigs or need an affordable solution to manage your direct-to-fan sales and mailing list, you can use Bandzoogle's simple tools to design a website and store that both you and your fans will love. Go to Bandzoogle.com to try it free for 30 days and use the promo code ATWI to get 15% off the first year of any subscription. That's ATWI to get 15% off the first year of any subscription. Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. I'm rarely starstruck, but today's guest is a future country Hall of Famer, legendary powerhouse, multi-Grammy winning, first ever CMA Female Songwriter of the Year, songsmith who crafts timeless lyrics, often through collaboration, and sometimes all by her lonesome. She has influenced the careers of Faith Hill, Tim McGraw, Hunter Hayes, and many more. She co-wrote perhaps the most genre-bending single of my lifetime, performed by our friends Little Big Town. But that's not all, folks. This woman has garnered multiple Grammy nominations for her work as an artist, continuing to influence the industry by doing. From Massachusetts, this songwriter writes so eloquently about family that we all feel related to her. And the writer is my social media friend, Lori McKenna.
That's amazing. This is amazing.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so, you know, I met you once in the hallway of Creative Nation.
Is that where we were?
I think so. It was like right by right by their kitchen.
Yep.
I was working with
love that kitchen.
Mags and and Luke there, and I saw you, and I was nervous. So here
I'm so nerve-wracking. I mean, why are you nervous? That can't happen.
You know, because you know, when you know there are some people who, you know, there are certain writers that are really good at storytelling, and we were talking about this, that there's a huge difference between types of songwriting. You know, you can write you can write emotion through subtext. You can write emotion through just saying, I feel blank. You know, you can tell a beginning, middle, and end. You know, you can say, this is my, this is how I, you know, all, as I say as a joke a lot, you know, like a song is like a commercial for like SwiftJet, where the chorus is SwiftJet, SwiftJet, SwiftJet. The pre-chorus is like, it's $9.99 for a limited amount of time. And your verses are, it cleans under couches and tables.
So smart.
And you do this about things like family. You know,
but
you tell these stories. Where does this come from?
I mean, my favorite thing is like you describe the room and then people put their story in it. Like you know what I mean? Like you give like the, instead of the general details, you give the tiny details and then you fill in the blanks, right? Yourself as a listener. I think it's just from growing up listening to music like that. I don't know.
So let's go from the beginning, you know, tell me about being born in Massachusetts and who your parents are.
So I'm the youngest of six, which Whoa. Is probably like formed me quite a bit, being the baby of six. Because it's always my fault, and I'm okay with that. It's like, of course.
You get used to
it. Of course it was me. And my dad, his name's Frank Giroux. He worked for the Boston Edison for 42 years, like, got dressed in the dark each day, like in a three-piece suit, and carpooled into Boston. We live like 20 miles south of Boston. And my mom passed away when I was like six or just turned seven. So my oldest brother was already out of the house and married, had a kid. And my second oldest brother, Donald, literally was like living away at college and like moved back home. And my brothers and my sister raised me.
Wow.
Yeah, like, so I have a super tight family, and all of us, like, musical, you know, I didn't take piano lessons, which I regret, I wish I did, but I just followed in my brother Richie's footsteps, because he played guitar and listened to all the cool music, you know, Neil Young, James Taylor, all that stuff, like, Jesus and James Taylor, I always say at my house, and I just did what they did, you know, my brothers and my sister.
Did you guys actually write songs together?
Never wrote songs together, but my oldest brother, Bobby, and my brother, Richie, write songs.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And professionally?
My brother, Bobby, did for a bit, and my Richie just never, he just never wanted to, like, that was his thing, like, he never wanted to leave the house, really, with it, but they super inspired, I remember Richie being like, okay, you know three chords, so you could write a song, and literally the first song I wrote was like a rodeo, something, like, I don't even know what was happening, like, how I got any of this information. When I was like 13, I wrote like a country song, and I remember playing it for him, he's like, how did you write a country song? Like, what do you know about the rodeo? I'm like, I don't know, I heard it on the radio or something.
And what was the song called?
I don't remember what it was called, but it was about a woman who like lost her man to the rodeo or something. No idea where I got this information. It was like 12 or 13.
I mean, that's insane. Did you actually play it outside of the family?
No. I never left my house until, oh God, I was probably like 27 before I sang in front of people.
What?
I have like a weird voice. All my siblings can sing really well. And I have a very distinctive, strange voice. So I didn't think I could sing at all. I just liked writing songs.
But now that you have your perspective now, would you tell that kid to have started singing out earlier?
I mean, half of me would, but half of me wouldn't. Because
Why?
I think, because I didn't edit myself. Like, I did never thought I was going to be able to do music professionally. Like, it was never even I just loved it. I didn't know you could even be a songwriter back then, and certainly didn't think I had the voice to present it myself. So I think that I didn't learn to edit myself in a way like, oh, what if someone hears this? Will they, you know, like, I wasn't writing, I was only writing for myself for so long. I think that was a benefit in the end, because I still don't edit in a way that I'm worried about what someone else will think. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So if I start, I wish I sang earlier, because I think my voice, maybe my range would have grown a little bit more, because I have a pretty small range. And I always think when people grow up singing all the time, it's a great benefit to their...
Yeah, there's that. But if by having a limited range, you're probably writing songs that more people can sing along to.
That's a good way to think
about it. You know, I mean, there's, because if you can sing the phone book, you're trying often to use that skill set.
Yeah.
And that's not really a good writing tool. You know, that's actually I think that hinders a lot of songs.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. I think my deficiencies have built my style 100%. Sure. And I think even the tone of my voice, like people are always like, why are your songs so sad? But it's like, literally, I think it's the tone of my voice. My tone of my voice is kind of sad. Like when I sing, it's like, if I sing you happy birthday, it's kind of sad. Because of the tone of my voice. So I'm really happy, but I like sad songs. And I also feel like I'm more apt to write them because the tone I have. I don't have a happy sound anymore.
When you're 13, you play this song for your brothers. And then you said you didn't really play out until you were 27. So there's sort of 14 years missing there.
I know. That's what I just like wrote songs in my bedroom, and mostly nobody really ever heard them.
So how often were you writing? Was this something where you became like, oh, wow, I'm just writing every day? Or is it, you know, you're just living your life, I got a song idea.
Yeah, if it like hit me, like if I was inspired, I would do that. I mean, I probably played guitar like almost every day, like because I was trying to learn. And I took lessons for like a year or 2 years, like 13, 14. But I always would just go in and ask the teacher to teach me like a Police song or something, which is super hard. And he'd be like, can't do that. I didn't want to learn I didn't want to learn the music theory. I just wanted to learn how to play.
Do you know the music theory now?
I know some of it. I finally learned the Nashville numbers like maybe a couple of years ago. And I play a lot in Dadgad, which is your numbers are so easy in Dadgad because you can only go so many places. So I know where all the numbers are in Dadgad. I just put my capo in a different, you know what I mean? But I have to count sometimes if I'm in standard tuning. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So I know very limited amount of theory. And I just hang out with people that know it and then they tell me what. So
when you write songs, at that time, there's, you know, when you were saying that you were able to write for yourself and not really worry about what other people thought of the songs, it's because, you know, when you're writing in your bedroom at that point, it's only you writing in your bedroom. Now I feel like when people write in their bedroom, they can't wait to put it up on TuneCore and get it out there.
Yeah.
And they don't necessarily have the learning curve. Of, you know, they don't have that ability to grow behind the scenes because they immediately put themselves out there.
Because it's available. It's so available.
Yeah. How did you memorize these songs? Were you recording them? Did you memorialize any of these songs from 13 to 27?
I definitely recorded some of them like old school, like the cassette tape thing, you know.
Do you still have them?
No. Oh, no. I was going to say, hell no.
Are you saying you don't have them, like you literally don't have them? Or you're saying,
gone. Yeah, I wouldn't even know where they... I have like paper and all that stuff written down, but as far as recordings, I don't think I have any of that stuff. I mean, this was back in the day. I remember my brother Richie like knowing a guy that had some stuff in his basement, you know what I mean? Because we were entering a song contest. This was like by the time I'm like 27. And what had happened was my brother Donald that moved home, you know, from college when my mom died and my family all raised me. His wife, Andrea, talked me into doing an open mic. And this is like 27, 28. I have three kids at this point, and I'm like, what the hell? I might as well do an open mic. Like, I've already, you know, given birth. Like,
sure.
What could be harder than
how
that?
How vulnerable can it
yeah,
be?
Yeah, like, right? So they literally, like, she puts me in a minivan with, like, and drives me up to this open mic in, what's the name of the town? It's called the Old Vienna Coffee House. And my siblings all come. My brother, I'm borrowing my brother's guitar. Like, and it's like the scariest thing I had done. You know, physically shaking, and I sang like two songs. And we all went back out to the minivan. I'm like, and the guy that ran the place came, like, followed us outside and said, "You should come back." And like, that's all I needed was like one little
sliver.
Like, this is someone that's not related to me that says he listened to my song and liked it. And I went back a month later, and he remembered me. He was like, "Oh, there you are." And so I just did, from that moment on, I just did whatever somebody told me to do.
Before we get to that, because that's interesting, but you know, you meet your husband in third grade, something like that. You get married at 19.
Yeah.
You have three kids.
Mm-hmm.
What were you? Were you? Were you working? Were you a stay-at-home mom? Were you able to pick up a guitar during any of that?
So that phase, I probably wrote a lot more during that time, believe it or not, than I did even when I was younger, teenager, because I worked for my brother Donald. He had a company. He's a chemist. He had a company. I worked part-time there. And but when I put my kids to bed, I would literally just like sit in their room for hours sometimes and just like sing them songs till they fell asleep. And my kids, my poor three oldest kids probably didn't get any sleep when they were little because I would like stay in their room for 3 hours every night after they fell asleep and just play guitar.
Yeah, I mean, I was asking because so much of your writing feels like it's like you're in that room with those kids.
Yeah, I was in there a long time.
So it you being inspired during that time to write and then go and perform it and then coming back, you know, clearly you're drawing from somewhere and that would be it.
That's why the word kitchen is in all my songs.
Really?
Yeah, I'm always in the damn kitchen. So much happens in the kitchen.
It does. Why is that?
I don't, because everyone likes the kitchen. I don't know what it is. You know, you go to a party and everyone's like, everything's set up in the living room and everyone stands in the kitchen.
Yeah.
So I can't get away from it.
No. I mean, do you cook?
Yeah.
Are you a good
cook? I'm not a great cook. I'm an okay cook.
Yeah.
I can do certain things.
Yeah, like what?
Like, I can pretty much cook anything if you teach me, if I have a recipe that isn't like a skilled, you know.
Right.
A basic recipe I can follow. But in my house, we have chicken a lot.
Yeah.
I have a picky eater. My youngest is a very picky eater. So it's like teriyaki chicken, broccoli, rice situation. A lot of rice.
It's really funny.
Yeah.
Okay, so you come back to the cafe. What was it called?
Old Vienna Coffee House, I think it was.
Does it still exist?
No, it's gone.
I was going to say we should contact them.
I know.
They're getting a lot of free press. Maybe they'll reopen.
It was like a legendary place at the time because like touring folk artists would come through there and like feature in the middle of the open mics. And there would be like 30 people on the list and like some national touring act would play for half an hour in the middle.
Crazy.
And they would play them on the folk station. So my brother and I decided that we would enter a song into like the WUMB song contest they had 1 year. And we literally had to find a guy that had some equipment in his basement to go. Like, I knew nobody that had gear and things like that. And we each recorded a song and entered the song contest. And I made it to like the semifinals or something.
Cool.
So all these things, just like I just kept following
hope,
like
hope,
this.
Hope.
Yeah.
What's the when you're writing at that time? I'm assuming, you know, that the songs sound like the songs you're releasing today, but that's probably not true, or maybe it is. I mean, what were the songs that you were playing in a cafe at 27 through whatever?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I think
were they country? Were they Americana? Were they?
They're definitely
probably
Americana.
Did you try different? Did you try different genres outside of that?
No, definitely not. I mean, I'm just like still so limited at this point, even today, so limited. No, but what was coming out of me just lent itself to, and I guess in Boston we called it folk music. And there's such a great community in Boston around that. And I also think if I didn't grow up near Boston, I would be doing something else, because that community there is really nurturing, where people kind of take care of each other when they're coming up. And that was always my experience with people. It wasn't like competitive. It was, you should do this. You should, you know.
Did you ever study poetry?
No. And I normally don't understand poetry.
Who were your musical influences that made you write with such detail? Because you're playing at open mics. There are people who went up there and are like, Sandy, me, I'm sad. I don't have a way to express this feeling now. And you're telling things about, like, I'm in the kitchen alone with nothing but a spatula and leftover food in the refrigerator. And I still feel like, oh, that person's sad and lonely.
Yeah.
But you didn't have to say, I'm sad and lonely.
Yeah.
Where did you learn to do storytelling?
I don't know why that was the approach that happened, but that was probably like where it started in the beginning. It was those details. Maybe that's all I knew how to do. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. But like I said, we grew up on, you know, Neil Young and songwriters, you know.
Who's the best artist for you when you were little that you just couldn't get enough of? Was it Neil Young?
It might have been Neil Young, just because the James Taylor stuff was difficult. Like, I could never learn how to play yeah. half the James Taylor song. And I always was drawn to the simpler songs. And obviously now I know they're not simple. You know what I mean? When you're 14, they kind of seem like they are. But I was always drawn to, like, that simpler stuff. And then I got, you know, when UMass Boston has this radio station, WUMB, and they had all day programming folk music. And that wasn't until I was like probably 17 or so, I figured all that out. Like, oh, this is like music I can listen to. Every fifth song, I'm going to like get what that person's doing. You know what I mean? And so,
did you ever meet the artists?
I met some of them like over the course of just once I started getting out and playing, you know, places like Old Vienna Coffee House and Passim, which is in Cambridge, which is still like a huge part of, like, that's like my musical home. It's just a great place.
Do you still
place.
Go there?
I still go there all the time.
Do you
like
play?
I play there all the time. Like, that's my home base. Like, it's just my favorite room. Like, if you live in Nashville, like Bluebird would be your favorite. Like, that's my Bluebird in Boston. It's like where all this good stuff happens.
From those moments of hope, you become a semifinalist in a national songwriting competition. What's the next step?
So I lost that, but I met Mark Arelli, who's my guitar player and dear friend, and we've been playing together ever since. And I learned, and that guy that followed me down, his name's Robert Haig from the coffee house, said you should save up money and you should make a CD. Like CDs had like, this was like 98?
Uh-huh.
And so you needed like $3,000 to make a CD at that point. And it was like just seemed like my husband's working, he works at the gas company, or maybe he didn't even have that job yet, but we got three kids. We have no business having three children, like at our age, you know what I mean? Like, we did not know what we were doing. And someone's like, yeah, you should save like $3,000 and make a CD. And I don't know how, like looking back, I don't really know how we did it, but I did. And then he hooked me up with a producer and that recorded like all those songs I had been singing at the open mics. Like, I just recorded 12 of them. I remember my brother Bobby being like, maybe you should wait. Maybe you should, like, what he was saying was, maybe you should have a little bit more experience singing out before you make a CD.
Was he right?
Yeah, he was right, but I didn't think he was right at the time. Like, I just figured, like, this is gonna go away any second. Like, surely this won't happen. This isn't gonna last. And I made a record. It was called Paper Wings and Halo. And they booked me a show at Passim, and I show up and it was sold out. Like, every time I did something that was uncomfortable or seemed completely unlikely, it always brought me to the next thing.
Yeah.
And each time I was like totally shocked it happened. Like, I never, like, got, like, the bitterness side of any of it, because I was always, like, flabbergasted that people showed up to this show. Like, how do you even know I'm here?
I mean, maybe if you started recording in 13, you would have seen more of the bitterness.
Yeah, maybe
but,
so.
But when you start later and you kind of appreciate each moment,
yeah,
because it is out of the wheelhouse. You could have, had you not been in Boston, you said you wouldn't have done music. So you start to appreciate those moments differently later, I feel like. You know?
And I also feel like I'm very practical minded about what my abilities are, like in contrast to other people's abilities. So it's like, I know there's people that are just going to blow me away at every turn. So I'm always just happy.
At what, though?
At anything, like playing, singing, stage presence, anything. Like, it's like,
Do you feel that way as a songwriter?
I feel like I can hold my own as a songwriter, but I still get scared. I get scared in a room. I have to talk myself into, like, okay, I can do this. Like, even if it's like, everybody has days like this, I'm sure, but if I'm not, a great contributor that day, at least, I'll learn something from it.
Yeah, but there's it's harder in a room of two people to see the balance. But, if you're in the room with three people, you have to contribute 33% to be an equal share. Mm-hmm. And my assumption is on your worst day, you're still, if you do this pre-chorus melody and maybe this, the lyric at the end of the chorus, and you added the lyrics in the second verse and maybe a slight part of the bridge, that's probably 33% of the song. if you really want to break it down, I think often we think that we're not contributing. But if you're in a room with seven people, you need 14.8%. I don't know. I'm screwing this up. But... six people, seven people would be 14.28%.
This is the math part.
Okay, but no, the idea that you all you have to do is contribute that to actually earn your piece is my point.
Sometimes I know I've had songs where I'm like, I think that just is mine. I have those days. And it's so, but I've worked on my, I've worked on, okay, you can't just fall apart when you get in the room. You have to, usually it
have
is.
Have you had sessions where you really just went blank and just did nothing?
I've had sessions where I felt like the other person didn't trust me. Like.
Really?
You know what I mean? Like as a writer, like if there's three people in the room and you know that they connect with the other person, but not you. I've had days like that, I've had days like that. That's what, I know we're jumping here, but the thing that I love the most about co-writing is that every song, even in the same day, if it's a two-song day or something, your role is totally different. Like, it's just like we have to do so many different things, like, at any given moment. And it's like, that's the funnest part for me is are you the cheerleader? If I'm just like the coffee, or the wine pourer that day, but I just got adjust in the lyric and I didn't help with the melody or whatever. As I've gotten older, I feel like, well, at least I poured the wine that day.
Do you think the other writers feel that way?
I don't know. I mean, that's what you always wonder.
Because do you feel that way when there's someone in the room and you end up, don't you end up feeling the exact opposite, which is, wow, maybe I didn't let that other person contribute. Like, you don't look at the other person wow, they didn't do their job never look at it like that.
I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, if the shoe's on the other foot, is that the expression? Yeah. But if the foot's on the other human, you don't look at them and think that they're not contributing.
That's such a good point. Remember that next time my brain starts killing me like that.
There are a couple writers, and I know the pop world's different, but there are a couple writers that I don't know really what they've ever contributed to the lyric and music, but may have the best taste in the world.
Yeah.
So, quite literally. And they can be in the room and they can say, this is better than that.
That's
we can
great.
Beat that. We can beat that.
Yeah.
That's a great editor can be also someone valuable without being the singer or the writer.
Yeah. You're right. I'm going to remember that. See, this is why I love this podcast.
Well, you know what? I'll just come and hang with you at every session and be the guy who contributes the word just. I'll take my 33% and
I love it. Absolutely.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This week's episode is sponsored by BMI. Full disclosure, Joe and I are both BMI songwriters. So we didn't write this, but we believe it. BMI, we celebrate your talent, value your music, and champion your rights. To all our songwriters and composers, your passion is ours. BMI, music moves our world. Today's podcast is brought to you by our friends at Bandzoogle. Built for musicians by musicians, you can use Bandzoogle's tools to easily design a website, an EPK, sell your music, merch directly to your fans, and it's commission-free. Bandzoogle also recently added a crowdfunding feature, which lets you crowdfund your next project commission-free. So think about it. Your fans want to help fund your album. You don't need a record deal anymore. You can just use Bandzoogle. So go to Bandzoogle.com, try it free for 30 days. Be sure to use the promo code ATWI, and you'll get 15% off your first year of any subscription. That's ATWI. At Bandzoogle.com for 15% off of any subscription. So you go from, you sell out this show and you have your own CD. Your brother says you should wait. You said maybe he was right, but there was clearly an audience. Were they buying the CD?
Yeah, so in that radio station, you know, UMB, which is still there and still a great part of, I think, the Boston community. It just, like, one thing happened after another. You know what I mean? It was just me following, like, whatever, like, little, you know, thread I could and pulling on it, but not being like ever all that confident that I could keep doing that. And
did you start making money then? Were you actually making more money than you were spending?
I made enough, like I always made money to pay back what I had spent, which was good.
Yeah.
And when you're living week to week, you know what I mean? With little kids and all that stuff. And then I got to the point where I would be able to like contribute, like the way I thought of it was like I could buy the groceries this week, like I made $250, you know, whatever it was. And then, but at that point it was like, it was going from a hobby that I had for so long, you know, putting the kids to bed singing songs or whatever, to, you know, mom's gone Friday night, she's got a show. And that was, you know, it's always a balance of any parent that has to work, which we all do, but. And then it was like more of a like, oh, is this a career? Like, do I do this? Like, and I still worked part time at my brother's company, and still one thing leading to another. So then I made another record with a band, and it was called Pieces of Me. And there was like a producer with a band, and I had never played with a drummer before. And I had so many years of playing by myself, like the whole timing thing was a whole other issue. Like, oh, we have to stay in time now? Like,
yeah.
And learning that, it's like so late in the game. Like, I'm so backwards at this point. And, but then that all worked out pretty well. And just becoming more part of that Boston community and doing my own shows and traveling a little bit in the Northeast. And then by then I had a manager and someone that would book shows. Like one thing just always led to another. And there's a label out in Western Mass called Signature Sounds. And they were licensing the records and putting them out for me. Mary Gaucher comes into my life at some, like early on at some point. And then she takes off and moves to Nashville. And we're like label mates and pals. Like, we could do shows together because we were kind of similar, like, in our songwriting style. She's a masterful songwriter, like, unbelievable. And I learned a lot from Mary, because every time Mary did something, she grew. Like, every time she made a record or every time she wrote another song, she grew. And it wasn't like, I think at that point, I still believed that you either had talent or you didn't. And it was like what you were born with. And Mary taught me that there's so much work you can put into yourself and your craft, and get, you can decide you want to do this and get better at it. And like, you have that right to do that. I feel like I just thought you either had it or you didn't.
And but the work ethic was something that was.
Yeah. And she moved to Nashville and just taught me so much, just in how she knew her range. She knew where her voice sat. And she, you know what I mean? And she crafted her songs around that. And I just, like, I just always watched what she did and sort of tried to do my version of that.
Was it hard to go? Because then you end up going to Nashville after that.
Well, I end up going to Nashville because of Mary, because she moves there and gives my record to a publisher. And they call, they literally, like, call. People are always like, you should write songs in Nashville. I'm like, I had only ever been there once. Like, I didn't
and you
know.
Have three kids and you're.
Yeah, I had no idea how it all worked. But Mary, I put out this record called Bittertown. By then, I have five kids. I guess Bittertown came out the same time my son David came out. So, a couple more kids, a couple more records, and I make Bittertown, and Mary plays it for a publisher named Melanie Howard, and she called me. Like, literally just called me one day, like, hey, can I pitch your songs around Nashville?
What was that conversation like when you came home and you talked to Gene, your husband, and you talked to the kids?
Well, Gene knew Mary growing up, you know, growing through this whole process. So, and I was like, hey, Mary, like, gave my record to somebody, and the woman called me, and she wants to pitch my songs around Nashville. And he's like, well, yeah, sure. Like, even then, we knew, like, that, I don't think that's how it happens. Like, I don't think.
How did you think
that's
going to
work? I knew people that had moved down there to write songs. So it's like, surely you have to. It's
go.
More than somebody just doesn't call you, you know? And then she called back. That record came out in May 2004. She called back in like August, Melanie. And she said, Faith Hill wants to hear everything you've written. And we're like, sure. You know, like, it was like, it was always like, surely that's not what's happening. And then by Thanksgiving of that year, she calls again. I still have never, like, have not been there. I just gave birth to David in May. Like, I'm like breastfeeding. And she calls and
it's so country.
It's like,
to be like, you know, this is like, it's exactly how this is supposed to go. You know, breastfeeding your fifth child, and somebody says Faith Hill wants to cut you. Just like, nah, I don't think so.
And I just kept taking these calls and be like, yeah, this doesn't sound right. I don't think this is how it works.
Uh-huh.
And then she called back at Thanksgiving and left me a message. I remember her and Mary, Melanie and Mary left me a message saying, Faith cut three of your songs. And again, we're like,
how did it feel to have? I mean, even hearing that, was there, if you're not intending to have other people record your songs, was there ever part of you that was precious about it, or you're like, oh, this is great, or did you?
Oh,
you
yeah,
didn't
I was
even
thrilled,
really know.
But I just like couldn't like let myself believe that was going to happen, because I didn't want the disappointment. That was surely, like, it was just, I'm sure it's around the corner, this disappointment thing. Like, there's no way this is actually happening. And the way I described that year from her cutting the songs to me hearing them was about 9 months or so. And I was in, you know, I went to Nashville by that point. And Missy Gallimore, who got the songs to Faith, she's like my angel. She played me Faith singing Fireflies, and I literally broke open. Like, my face, like, literally broke open with this release of, like, oh, my God, I get to do this.
Yeah.
Like, I had no, to that point, I was, like, just really preserving. Like, I think I was, like, really just staying intact, because I didn't want to, like, dream too big here, because then I would really be crushed. And I really don't deserve any of it, because I was just breastfeeding a kid and got a phone call. Like, I didn't put the
work in. Why use the word deserve?
Because there's so many people that go to Nashville and they, you know, just pound the pavement. Like, my kids are right now, you know what I mean? And I hadn't done any of that.
Weren't you... I mean, it's not your first album. It's not like you weren't playing some shows during this time.
Yeah, but there's such a luck factor there. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Such a luck factor. And I didn't know why I got to be that lucky.
Why do you think you got to be that lucky?
I guess I don't know exactly, but I feel like I have been... I definitely think I was super lucky, but I also feel like I've been fair to the luckiness. Like, I've appreciated it. Now, doing this for so long now, I feel like I never, like, ever still think I deserve more, like, than what I work for. And I feel like I'm grateful for that stroke of luck. And I've had many others since, you know, obviously, but I feel like I'm grateful to the experience I feel like I won the lottery and I didn't play. They just like knocked on my door.
Fireflies, if you ask, Lone Star, Stealing Kisses are all 100% songs, Bible songs for Sarah Evans too. And those are your first real cuts.
Well, I had never co-written.
Sure, totally.
Yeah.
No, I'm just saying, like,
yeah,
you know, the... Even going in more blind into the industry, you see how rare that is,
yeah,
to have 100% songs. You know, there's a practical side of this, and where if you have three writers, you need to have three times as many songs come out,
mm-hmm,
you know,
yeah,
to have that success. I imagine that did any of the family dynamic change because of the success of, you know, the first songs you have coming out? These are huge names. Obviously, Faith Hill and Sarah Evans, mm-hmm, and then Tim McGraw and Mandy Moore at the time. Like, you know, they're real artists, and you're,
yeah,
and they're and it's, they must have all been cutting these songs that pre-existed. I know some of these become,
right,
co-writes where you're in the co-writing world, but how did it affect your family dynamic?
Well,
and why didn't you move to Nashville? I would assume that that's been a discussion over the years, you know?
So, yeah.
Well, this is a, yeah, huge, you know, you didn't play the lottery, you win the lottery.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how does someone deal with winning the lottery?
I think what happened with us is because of the kids being, so David was just born, my son David, he's 15 now, he was just born when all that happened. And I had, like, kids in high school. Like, we live in the town that my husband and I both grew up in, this town called Stoughton. And they're in high school, middle school, all over the place, right? And I always had this, like, big fear when I was little that we were going to move and I'd have to change schools. Like, it seemed like the scariest thing in the whole world. So I never wanted to pull my kids out of school unless they all wanted to. But surely five kids are not going to all want to do anything like that. My husband now has a really good job. You know what I mean? My dad, I can walk to my dad's house. We can walk to the house Gene, mm-hmm, grew up in. Like, we're just so embedded there in that town. It didn't really make sense to ever pull anybody out for me. You know what I mean? Like, hey, mom wants to do something. Everyone pack up. We're out of here. Like, it just never made sense for that to happen. And so, you know, just take a plane and you go down there.
Real quick, and not to interrupt, mm-hmm, but in this next segment, what would Luke Laird ask Laurie McKenna? He had asked, what is her favorite high school memory of her Ford Escort in high school?
I didn't have the Ford Escort in high school. I think I had it right after. He is so bad, Luke Laird. I mean, this is the thing. We went to see Home Alone at with the symphony in Nashville, and they had like that, the pizza delivery car, like outside, and I was like, I had that car. Like, literally had that same car. Yeah, lots of memories though in cars in high school. Don't cars in high school go together? He's making fun of me because I've never dated anybody but my husband.
There you go.
He knows we have had some car experiences.
Fantastic. Okay, so sorry to interrupt. But so I can see why you wouldn't want to leave home when you have a, you know, you have a Ford Escort and five children. And
and the family dynamic really didn't change that much because you know how long this process takes. Like the song gets cut and then the artist puts the song out, what 9-12 months later, you know what I mean? And then Faye takes me under her wing, but all this still seems so surreal. And we do the Oprah show and I go and do shows with her and like all these, it's like pure craziness.
What do you mean you guys did I didn't know about the Oprah show.
Well, she, when that record came out, her record Fireflies came out, she was going to be on the Oprah show and they pulled me in and said, hey, we just like have this new writer that has never written a Nashville. And so I went and did the show
ended
with
up being part of the story. Yeah.
Which seemed like, you know, the songwriter plucked from, you know, like I was in my backyard breastfeeding and Faith came along. But in a way, you know, I'm like at home.
It's Mary not true.
It's not the word. I mean, it's kind of what, like Mary gives the record to Melanie Howard, who gives the record to Missy Gallimore, who gives the record to Faith. And it's those four women. If those four women don't do those four things, I'm still in my kitchen.
I mean, it's crazy. What did your siblings feel, and your family and your friends, everybody from, mm-hmm. you know, your, from your childhood seeing you on Oprah?
Yeah, that my family is like outrageously supportive and always has been. My friends from, you know, I didn't go to college, so my friends from high school are still my hometown friends. And they all just sort of have, you know, taken this ride with me, like, you know, like learning all these things and all been there, like from the very beginning and still, you know.
So even from then, basically to 2015, you know, there's... You have a number of successes, certainly, you know, like, you know, songs that charted very high and clearly you're making a living as a songwriter. But, you know, 2015 comes in and, or really, I guess, you know, I Want Crazy is sort of this new phase. I feel like, to me at least, this is when maybe I was getting into songwriting, so I became more aware of what, you know, who the writers were.
Yeah.
But, a new phase of artists come in where you have your work with Little Big Town starts to come in right around then. You're spending a lot of time with Creative Nation at this point. When did you sign to Creative Nation?
I think around then. I was with Universal. So I was with Melanie Howard for 4 years and then Universal and then Creative Nation. And that was like a big turning point for me. Between Universal, which I've enjoyed all of my experiences with publishers, and but Beth Laird, who, you know, owns Creative Nation, is my manager and publisher, and she's been like a big part of me maintaining like my artistry, which is a big part of the way I write, and she sort of taught me like to bridge the, because everyone wants to separate it. Like, what songs do you keep for yourself and what songs do you pitch? And it doesn't really, you know what I mean? It's like, I just write songs. Like, and she's the one that kind of taught me, like, you have to like go out and play your shows because that's a part of what you do. It's always the process I've done it. And you write better songs when you maintain that part of your work. And
that's got to be hard too, because, you know, if Tim McGraw cuts your song, the floor is higher as far as how much money you make. But that's not necessarily the same thing as maintaining that artistry.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it's the for a long time, the publishing kept touring going because, you know, touring is expensive. It's like you have to make, especially if you bring, you know what I mean? It's like it's funded. It still does sometimes fund the touring part of it. But Beth sort of like has taught me like, but this is important for you. It's an important piece of the way you write and how you write. And if it inspires and feeds that part of it, it's important. You know what I mean? And now we're sort of leveled off with all that. But the publishing came in at a time when I like back in the day when Faith showed up, you know, in my backyard and all that happened. I probably would have had to made some sort of decision, you know, around that time. Like, am I still going to put out records and, you know, save this money to make a record and hope I make the money back when I have all these kids and everyone's going, you know, college soon and things like that. If music always somehow, when it got to the point where it's like, can I still do this? Something would always come along and say, yeah, you can still do this.
If you were petrified from playing shows, at least that first one, and you have people like Faith Hill cutting your songs, what's the motive for putting out music as an artist?
I think for me, especially at that time, so before Faith, I didn't know how to co-write, so I had never co-written a song. And there was like a part of singing it in front of an audience that I think made the song better for me. Like I would learn my phrasing that way. I would learn how to read an audience, like what they were like taking to, you know, what song somebody comes up to at the end of your show and says, oh, that song about your mother, which is like so personal, so detailed, like so not anybody else's story. Like five people just said to me, like, they like the song about my mother. That's weird. You know what I mean? Like you think, like, nobody's going to get the song. It's completely for me. You sing it and then someone's like, oh,
I get it.
Yeah.
Because they had a mother.
They have a mother, too, and there right. It is. And so I learned so much about what I was writing, what I was saying from audiences and from being vulnerable and getting up there in front of them and singing, you know?
Not to skip ahead, but in 2015, that's the first, you know, you won Song of the Year that year. You also, it starts this new, sort of a new level of expectation, I feel like, maybe, also, because you start having, it seems like every song you write is a song that other people wish they wrote,
Not the case.
but, you know, you have Girl Crush what I was referring to in the intro. It comes out and, you know, there's country radio is so male centric in the 2010s.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if the word sexist is right or what is the right way to describe country radio, but certainly a song like Girl Crush caused a stir.
Yeah.
And it's so beautifully written, but it's a game-changing song. Was it hard to find someone to cut the song and have the chutzpah, if you would, to release the song and then actually make it the single? No, I believe it was the second single.
All those things happened like by mistake, though, because so I wrote that song with Liz Rose and Hillary Lindsay, and we call ourselves the Love Junkies. We named ourselves. I don't know why, but I'm glad we did because it's so much easier than like typing all three of our names at the top. I was like Love Junkies, and y'all can you hear my stomach? My stomach's growling. As long as it's not on here.
You want some more croissant?
No. Okay. I can't eat. That would be terrible. Then I'd be chewing.
I'm just chewing while you're talking.
Chew while I'm talking.
I mean, weirder things have happened. Not many weirder things, but weirder things.
That would
things.
Be weird. No, but
yeah, so love junkies.
Love junkies. So I don't live in Nashville, so I always stay at Liz's house. We convinced Hillary that she needs to stay there too, even though she lives in Nashville. And she hadn't had her daughter yet, so she's upstairs asleep. And Liz and I get up early, and we're drinking coffee in her kitchen. She's like, what are we going to do today? Because Karen Fairchild and Kimberly Schlappman from Little Big Town are coming over at like 11 to write. And it's like 8:30, and Liz is like, what are we going to do today? Are we going to write before they show up, or should we just like get some ideas, you know, all that? And we're not good at like the ideas before the artist thing happens, because with Karen and Kimberly, like, it's just, there's a lot of girl talk, and then, you know what I mean, it usually comes out of all that. So I said to Liz, I want to write a song called Girl Crush. I'm like looking through my titles, and I had no other thought in my head about that title other than, like, you would see it, like, on social media, like, hashtag, like, you know, like,
yeah,
Girl Crush.
Sure.
You saw it all the time. And Liz is like, isn't that like a hashtag thing that, you know, like, what does that even, you know, what does it even mean? And I don't know. I don't think we have time for that. And Hillary came down about a half an hour later, and she's sitting on the couch, and she, there's a guitar beside her. And I said, I want to write a song called Girl Crush. And she sang the first four lines of that song, like, picked up the guitar. She doesn't know what she's playing. She's like bar chords, everything. Like, she just follows her ear, and she never knows what key she's in and all that stuff. And she just literally sang it, the first four lines. And Liz, who's kind of annoyed at me because she didn't want to write it, hears her and is like, holy shit, like, what was that? But those four lines form where the song is going, how it's 6/8, it's, you know, how it feels, just like that. Like, she didn't even know what she said. Like, it fell out of her face, like, just like that.
Hmm.
And it was one of those things, like, if you had a video of it, it would be, you'd watch it every day. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and the really good writers are ones that can take a title that seems like it means one thing.
Yeah.
And flip it very quickly.
She flipped it, and
so
she didn't even realize.
Girl Crush as a title on its own, my assumption is that you'd write a, you know, a teeny bopper song.
Exactly.
Because that's how it's, but it, in the context of the,
mm-hmm,
the song, it's just, it, I could see why someone would immediately after first, you know, few lines, shift their point of view.
And yeah. It was
start
so,
to become a fan of it, even in the room, you know?
Yeah, it was just so smart. And then we immediately thought, well, no one's going to do this. So by the second verse, you just go there because surely no one will cut this song. I mean, I might do it on my little record, like, you know what I mean? But surely no one, you know, it's too tricky. Like, you have to listen, you know, to get this. And so we just went there and recorded it. And iPhone probably took us an hour and a half, right? And because it's falling out of Hillary. You know what I mean? We're just chasing her and writing it down.
Yeah, making sure you don't miss
anything. For real. And then Karen and Kimberly showed up at 11 with like a plate of brownies, and we're going to write all day. And they're like, what have you all been doing? And Liz is like, play them that song. We didn't know if it made enough. Like, you know how some, you're talking about a song all day, so it makes sense to you in the room. But we didn't know if it was going to make sense to a new listener. And Hillary was kind of mad because she didn't want, you know, she didn't want to play for a Little Big Town, the song that we just sang in an iPhone that she, you know, it's still like 9:30 in the morning. And Liz played it, and Karen was immediately like, I need that song. Like, so there was nothing, there was no demo, there was never a demo. It went from Hillary's face to Karen's ears within hours. And we were just happy if they cut it. Like, you know what I mean? And then what happened was when the record was coming out, they had a listening party, and then other songwriters in town started texting all of us and saying, holy shit, this song is so cool. Like, you found a new way to talk about jealousy. Like, you found a new way. Like, every day we wake up and we have to write a new song about the same stuff, right? And you, mm-hmm, found a new way to do it. And we're like, we did? Like, and then when songwriters start, you know, commending you on your song, you know, that's like the best thing for all of us, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's like, I just remember just the phones blowing up when people started hearing it. And then I think it was a single by mistake. I don't know the story, but I think like Bobby Bones played it or something, and like it became a single because people reacted to it. I don't know.
You know, it just lived on like the top of iTunes when iTunes, you know, still was the thing. It just lived there. You know, it was just there. It was there all year.
It's crazy.
It's so crazy.
It's crazy. But all those things happened by mistake. Like, none of it was like, obviously, I don't know how you could pre-plan any of it. But also just the way they cut it, like Karen's vocal, the way Jay Joyce produced it, like the restraint in that track.
it's not just it's certainly not it's not always just the song. That performance is incredible.
It's incredible, and every time she sings it, it's incredible.
Did it, that having success as a songwriter and as a collaborator is one thing, but having a song like that sort of jump around all different genres and was a topic of conversation.
Mm-hmm.
How did that affect you as a writer? Because that starts to be, in the pop world, everyone uses the word edgy too much. But on some level, the word that's a really edgy song, or it seems edgy. How did it inform the way you would write? Did it inform any future writing?
Well, I think because I was always careful about not editing, because I, because I had written just alone and nobody mm-hmm. hearing things for so long, that it proved to me like the point of like the danger, if there's a danger in co-writing, it's only, is someone going to overthink this? Is someone going to over-edit this? Is someone going to take away this great idea or this piece of magic that literally came out of Hillary?
Yeah.
Are we going to follow that magic, or are we going to Nashville up the song or commercial up the song so we can get a cut? And we knew so early on that no one would ever cut the song, that we served the song. Like, I feel like we served the song that day instead of like, will we get a cut? Can this be played out? Like, our brains just shut that off. And then that all happened by mistake. And I think if it changes your writing, it just proves your point, which we all know, that we're there to serve the song. And I know we have to worry about making a living and all the and staying relevant and all those things, but we have to serve our craft first, or just say like, fuck it, like,
yeah, be
let's
vulnerable.
Do what the song wants
yeah,
to do. Like,
totally. it's also, I tell my writers a lot. I'm like, it's just a song.
Yeah.
So you just go there and you can write another one. We kind of gloss over you going from being a solo writer into walking into rooms and writing with mm-hmm. other people. But clearly that's sort of the pinnacle of experience, having co-written. The next biggest song you have in your discography is Humble and Kind, which mm-hmm. you wrote alone. The process of writing with other people versus writing alone at this point is totally different.
Yeah.
I would assume.
Yeah.
Because you still have your co-writers in your head when you're writing alone now.
Yeah.
In a different way.
Because
you didn't
true.
Even know that you had co-writers before. You know?
That's true.
Why write songs alone at this point?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the process of writing Humble and Kind when at this point you're writing almost, a lot with other people?
Yeah, I'm mostly co-writing at this, like, to this day.
Mm-hmm.
So just real quick, because I know I probably skipped over it, I'm sorry. But when I did get that publishing deal with Melanie Howard because of the Faith Hill cuts. And she's like, you have to come to Nashville once a month. Give me 2 or 3 days and I'm going to set you up with co-writes. And Sarah Evans was one of the first people I co-wrote with. Strangely, like, I don't know
crazy.
How she had the balls to put me with an artist, or why Sarah even said she would do it. And they put me with Mark D. Sanders, and they put me with Liz Rose. And these people taught me how to co-write. So up until that point, I had been part of this Boston community of, like, great players, great songwriters, great, like, just everyone jump up on stage and play each other's songs, like harmonize with one another. No, like, I know none. I can't harmonize unless you teach me. I can't play anything except for a little bit of guitar. You know what I mean? Like, I play the way I play, but I'm not going to be like, hey, what key are we in? And just follow you along. So I never had that sense of community. I never, like, I always felt like I can write I know my songs are okay enough for me to be here, to be part of this party, but I can't jump up on stage and help you with your song. And I always understood that about myself, like, that's okay. But when I started co-writing, immediately, I was like, oh, here's my community, like, is in other writers, because it doesn't have to be my song today. It can be your song today. It can be a song that we all know nobody's going to like. Like, you know, girl crush or nobody's going to get, but we have to do, for whatever reason, we have to do it today. And today I'm the cheerleader or the wine pourer or today I'm the artist and it's a song about my dog and I'm going to, you know, we're all going to cry or whatever. That's where I figured out, like, I can really help people musically here in the crafting of the song. And so I just immediately loved it. And people in Boston told me, like, oh, you never co-wrote before. It's going to mess you up. It's going to, like, it's not going to be the same. And I never had that problem. Like, I lucked out somehow, like, because I still like writing by myself. I just don't do it as much because I freaking love co-writing. I love the experience that it gives you. It takes me musically to places that I don't know how to do by myself, which is great. Gets you out of your own, like, melody head, you know? Like, I feel like sometimes I'm just doing the same thing. I'm writing the same song over and over again. So together, I just always, you know, immediately loved co-writing.
And do you save ideas for yourself or for certain sessions?
I save ideas, but usually not for one specific thing or another. You know what I mean? But I will say that sometimes I have to stew like on a night, like a title, like I have to walk around with it in my head for a couple of days. And sometimes I'll know if I shouldn't co-write it, if I should try to do it by myself, because I might get lost if someone else tries to help me. With Humble and Kind, that just happened because I was home when it hit me. You know what I mean? And I wasn't in Nashville, and nobody was home at my house. I dropped my kids off at school, and I just came back and sat there all day and wrote it. But
did you send it to Tim?
I did. I recorded it in my phone and emailed it to him. But if I had been in Nashville, like Liz, I think, called me up and be like, why didn't you, what's going on? Like, you couldn't, you couldn't wait. But it's like, sometimes I think if the song gets you, like when the song comes, when it makes sense in my head, that's when I have to do it. Because it might not make sense tomorrow if I don't do it. And that's happened to me a couple of times. That's a really good
piece of advice. You know, how many times have you looked at a title and you're like, that's not a good idea. But if had you just written it at that moment,
it would have
made sense because you would have thought through the...
Yeah.
Yeah, no 100%. Doubt. The next year you win Songwriter of the Year for a CMA's first female to win that.
Yeah, for the ACMs.
Or ACMs, mm-hmm. That's what it was. Mm-hmm. Backwards. There's so many awards.
I know.
when you do that... is there a shift right now in the, you know, and I alluded to it earlier, I feel like I was pretty blatant in it, but is country music starting to come around and listen to female writers and female artists again, and maybe more so than ever before? It's like, when is there a shift in music right now?
I don't know. I mean, as long as I've been going to Nashville, which is, you know, 15 years now, someone's been saying, the women are coming, like, they're going to start playing more women on the radio. That, like, I can feel the change. I can feel this change coming. And I don't know what that is all about. But I know the writers in that town, and I mostly write with women, to be honest. Like, the ones that I write with are, you know, Liz, Hillary, Natalie Hemby. You know what I mean? Like, I don't always write with women, but I write with a lot of women in that town. So the way I think Nashville sees writers, and I would assume it's the same in LA, is a writer is a writer, and it doesn't matter.
It just
matters how good you are.
I will say that, you know, and some of the artists you work with, Carrie Underwood, Miranda Lambert, Little Big Town, there are a lot of, there aren't a lot of women that have the opportunity in the pop world to kind of be the point person on songwriting for a certain artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Miranda has a lot of women around her to write her albums.
Yeah.
You know.
And she does it all herself. She organizes it herself.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, there are a lot of men writing a lot of female projects in LA, or, you know, it'll be three guys and a female.
Mm-hmm.
It won't be, you know, it won't necessarily be one guy in the room ever. Yeah. It's rarely that. I can't remember. I don't know if I've ever been in a session where I'm one of four people and I'm the only guy.
Really? Yeah.
You know, and I feel like there's... and conversely, you know, writing the Tim McGraw song, you know, or Nicole writing Tequila. You know, like these songs don't necessarily... you know, I don't know that many male pop songs that have a lot of female writers on it. There are obviously some, you know.
Yeah. I mean,
famously, Julia has done that a lot, you know.
There aren't
a ton of female writers that have that opportunity.
I think, like, the ACM thing, because when that happened, the ACM award came after Humble and Kind. So I think that was a representation of, like, here's this songwriter that wrote this song by herself, and maybe that's where that came from. But I remember my sister calling and be like, how did Dolly Parton ever win this award, or Loretta Lynn win this songwriting award, this, you know, songwriter of the year award? But the history of that award had only been around for like the last 10 years. So it's like, it's not really in the history of ACMs is this the first woman who won Songwriter of the Year. It's a 10-year-old award, or 7 years. It's only been around for a shorter time period.
Still the first. Do you, you know, we're recording this in your hotel room the day before the 2020 Grammys. Mm-hmm. You are... again, nominated in multiple categories for Song of the Year, Country Song of the Year. You've been nominated as an artist. Do any of the nominations mean more than others? Does it all feel surreal? Are you getting used to getting nominated? Do you get disappointed when a year goes on and you don't get a nomination?
No, there was not last year, but the year before, we were at home and my husband and I were watching the Grammy. He's like, are you sad you're not there? I'm like, no. Like, I still can't believe I ever get to go here. Like, these nominations were... like, we were shocked. We were all on the phone with each other. The day the nominations came out, I didn't even know. Like, I wasn't even aware they were coming out that day. I should have been, but I didn't know that they were coming. I happened to be in Nashville for board meetings, and I guess Hillary called Liz called about the Miranda song. Like, oh my God, Miranda's song is like nominated for Song of the Year, which was, we were shocked. It was 15 on the chart at the time. So you figure to be nominated for Song of the Year, it's got to be like a hit. It's got to have time for it to be a smash. The same day, it was also like dropped. It was the single was not pulled, but I don't know all the things, but like the radio people decided it's not researching. We'll let it go. Like the same day. And we're all on the phone together. And Hillary, and I'm talking to Hillary about, we're going to have really good seats because the Gaga song is overall Song of the Year, but I didn't say those words out loud. And she's like, what would you split with the country people? Like, country's pre-tell. And we're talking about two different things because she doesn't know about the overall Song of the Year with the Lady Gaga song. And then she's got another nomination for visual, whatever, because the end credit song Hillary wrote as well. And it was just like the three of us on the phone back and forth being like, is this really happening? We really get to go again? You know? So even when you know, like, there's no, we won't win, you have to, like, the nomination is unbelievable. You know what I mean? Like, you have to come and
you've won Grammys before. What do you do with the actual trophies?
They're on my piano
in
my living room that I can't play.
Do you dust them?
I do.
Yeah, of course. As you should.
I do.
You know, I have... we'll go to this last segment, which is going to be 5 for 5. I'm going to list 5 things,
okay,
and you're just going to tell me the first 5, because I know it's a busy time, so... we're going to go... Let's go with Liz Rose, your first collaborator.
Mm-hmm. So, wait a minute. Can we... Because I listen to this podcast. Sometimes it's a one-word answer, and sometimes it's a sentence or a paragraph.
Yeah.
Which do you want?
Which do you want it to be?
It just depends
let's,
on...
Let's go with one-word answer, unless there are more.
Okay, let's go. Liz is a wizard. I think she's a wizard.
Yeah, she really
is. She is, like, the wizard.
Yeah. I mean, we're both on the NMPA board thing. She was also like maybe my first or second co-write ever
really?
In Nashville.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you,
she's
just not, you could never look at Liz Rose, sit with her, talk to her, and not, you wouldn't think that she's one of the most accomplished songwriters
mm-hmm.
because she just doesn't. She doesn't have the, you know, she's not like showy.
No.
She's great.
She's the best. She's definitely a wizard because she really knows every aspect. She knows what behind the curtain, in front of the curtain, everything. She just knows it all.
It would be wrong for me not to ask then Hillary Lindsay.
100% genius. I believe she is she is the most genius songwriter I've ever been around. And I tell her that all the time. She thinks I'm full of shit, but I mean it. I think I've seen magic flow out of her.
I'm sure Luke would be offended by that, but let's go with Luke. Let's go with Luke and Beth Laird next.
They are the best. Beth has been so much to me. You know, I love them on many levels, like just as humans, but creatively and business-wise, because I'm not so good at the business part, they've been just really instrumental in what I get to do and have made a lot of things happen for me. And I love them.
Faith Hill and Tim McGraw.
Angels.
Yeah.
Freaking love them. I love those McGraws. They're the best. I don't know. I mean, without Faith, I have a different career. You know what I mean? I don't know what I'd be doing. Like working at Dunkin' Donuts maybe because I love coffee. But
and they, donuts. I mean, donuts are cool.
Yeah. I don't know how I got so lucky for Faith Hill to be my guardian angel, but she's like my angel on earth.
And finally, Gene McKenna.
Gene. Oh, he's the best. He puts up a lot for me. You know, the whole balancing thing, which I lose balance sometimes, and he's just always, he's there for the party. He's always there. He's 100%.
Yeah. What's advice you'd give to a young writer?
Well, yeah, I would say that you have to be able to sing your songs. Not all of them, but you have to be able, even if you don't think you can sing, I think you have to be able to interpret your songs. I think you can't expect anything from the business because you don't ever, I don't know anybody that would get into this now that is not doing it because they love the craft of songs.
Totally.
There's no other reason to do it. And I've talked to, you know, the kids at Berkeley, you know, in Boston during the summer camps and things sometimes. And, you know, back in the day, maybe you could go into this thinking, oh, I'll make a great living writing songs, but I don't think it makes sense for anybody to go in it now thinking that because of how everything has changed. I was never on the side of, I never had a song that made, you know, so much money like they did back in the day. So I didn't miss it, you know what I mean? Because I never knew it was coming, but the way the industry has changed so much for writers, like I can't imagine anybody wanting to hustle and grind so hard for something that they didn't love. Like if you weren't gonna be 90 years old somewhere still wanting to write a fucking song, like there's no way you should start now unless you love it that much.
Totally. Do you know what the hero's journey is?
No.
Have you ever heard that? It's sort of a, you know, it's a Greek way of telling a story where you have the hero leaves home because an incident happens and somebody tells them along the way, they come across a bunch of mentors. This is sort of what Star Wars is based on. A lot of movies are this. but they leave home because somebody says you have to leave home, and you don't know the journey, but people along the way show you the journey. Mm-hmm. And you learn, and you become the expert, and you come back home with the experiences you've had, mm-hmm. and you know, you become sort of the hero who comes home. You know, it can be a drama, it can be a tragedy, whatever
yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
You know, and you have a cafe manager and Mary and Missy and Faith and mm-hmm. all these people along the way it's rare that you come across a real human who has a real hero's journey. But to go from, you know, you're breastfeeding your fifth child to having a, you know, the Faith Hill hearing the music, it's because of all these mentors along the way, including Faith,
yeah,
to bring you to the Grammys yet again. You know, the hero's mm-hmm. journey is still going mm-hmm. for you. But it's so clear that you're the hero in a really cool story. And it's fun to watch because they're, you know, like I said, I can name the three or four other writers where there are two or three songs that I wish I wrote, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't normally wish I wrote songs. I normally am critical of the songs and think that I could have written it better. And it's rare that you come across people who have, you know, both the skill set and the, I hate this word, but stick-to-itiveness, you know, to get through being a songwriter in an era where it's not really about money, you know, yeah. and it's hard to be an artist when everybody wants, you know, it would have been easy to, as you said, Nashville up the song. I mean, we do the same thing here where it's like, it could be a really good song and people just screw it up because, you know, how does somebody write A Day in the Life or Yesterday?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, those songs don't get written now because somebody in there is like, well, we can't release a song that long. Yeah.
Barry Dean says that all the time. He's like, he's taught me so much too. But it's like, you know, if someone said, you know, Mother Mary, you know, speaking of, like, it's somebody would be like, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, totally. Like that. But I do appreciate the person in the room also that has that brain. That, like, if you can write a song, like you said, like, that people can sing along to, there's something to that, too, that's important. Like, I feel like you have to be mindful of those things without going, you know, overboard in any direction. It's, like, that's why the thing about songs is they're never going to get boring. Like, to us, we're never going to know how to do it 100%. Like, we're never going to be able to learn everything. We're just going to have to keep following it. It's like the greatest thing in the world when you think about it.
Totally. You know? Well, thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited.
Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer Is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to David Silverstein from Mega House Music and Michael White. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.